Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hey.
How are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
Good.
As well.
I'm so glad.
Yeah. What are we doing here today?
Today we're going to be talking about a story that is so crazy that honestly it could be a movie.
I feel like most of them can't be, but okay.
Yeah.
For you to say that outright intrigues me.
Yeah. The things that happen in this story are just like, what the hell?
Okay.
So.
Is that going to be the title? Just what the hell?
I mean, it could be, honestly.
Okay.
But before we jump into that story today, I wanted to let you know that when this episode comes out, bonus episode number 55 poll will be out over on our Patreon. So if you want to vote and hear all of our episodes that have been chosen by our patrons, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. They're all very good. Not to pat us on the back, because they're not our stories. We just tell them. But like...
Right, but you know,
they're very interesting.
We're doing good stuff over there.
My point is that the patrons pick well.
They do.
And if you want to go over there and hear all of those cool stories, check it out.
Yeah, and never an ad.
No.
No ads.
None to be found. And our episodes come out early over there, so it's all good stuff. But without further ado, why don't we get into our story for this week, because it's nuts.
Okay.
Okay. This case contains details that may be distressing to some. Listener discretion is advised. On April 21st, 2001, employees at a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant in East Cleveland, Ohio, were in the middle of their usual Saturday afternoon shift. It was a bright and warm spring day, and lots of people were out. This specific location was on one of the city's main roads, Euclid Avenue, and it was shaping up to be a very normal day. But early that evening, around 5:30 p.m., a young woman, who was covered in blood, came bursting through the doors, screaming for help. When the woman ran through the door, she was hysterical as she yelled, "They tried to kill me. Can someone please call 911?" She was shaking, blood pouring from her face and the back of her head, and it appeared that she was having trouble staying on her feet. The employees of this KFC were extremely shocked at the sight of her, but through her hysterical pleas, they managed to figure out that her name was Melissa Latham. She said a man and a woman had attacked her and injected her with something, and she had just managed to escape. When first responders arrived, they found 27-year-old Melissa Rochelle Latham in a state of shock. She had a large laceration on her forehead and was bleeding heavily from her scalp. Melissa told first responders that there was a woman across the street and her male cousin that had assaulted her and tried to kill her. She was coherent, but not doing well. And their initial reaction was that she may be suffering from some kind of psychotic or drug-induced episode. Melissa had mentioned being injected with something, and she appeared to be in rough shape and possibly homeless. Paramedics did receive a lot of drug-related calls in East Cleveland, rarely ever this intense, but they had seen this kind of thing before, so they didn't quite know what to make of it yet. Melissa hadn't gotten into anything that led up to this attack, but she seemed very believable. However, they didn't know what was going on, and they couldn't 100% be sure. As they were getting a closer look at Melissa's wounds, another woman walked into the KFC. She was put together and well-dressed, but she was shouting, "Stop that woman and call the police." The woman's name was Tonica Jenkins, and she told officers on the scene that Melissa had just stolen $1,000 from her and her cousin. But at the sight of Tonica entering the KFC, Melissa began freaking out. She actually climbed over the counter to get away from her. She was so terrified. She was screaming, "That's her! That's the lady who tried to kill me!" And nobody in this KFC knew what was going on. Both of these women had very different stories, and one of them was very seriously injured, with her condition only getting worse. So in an effort to try to figure out what was going on, police decided to take Tonica outside and ask her some questions while paramedics tended to Melissa. Tonica told police Melissa had stolen money from her and her cousin, Kyle Martin. And as Melissa had inside, Tonica also seemed very believable. She didn't have any marks on her, and she seemed very clean-cut, and pretty much kept with her story that Melissa had stolen $1,000 from them. She told police she was absolutely not involved with the assault of Melissa. And as officers continued speaking with Tonica, Melissa began losing consciousness, and it became clear that she needed to go to the hospital. The EMTs heard Melissa say that she had been injected with insulin, and now that was starting to affect her body. So as Melissa was being wheeled into the ambulance, she pointed at a home across the street from the KFC on Delmont Avenue and told officers that was where the assault had occurred. One of the women at this scene was lying, and officers needed to figure out which one.
How shocking. Like, not only is there a crisis to deal with, now you have to decide, like, what happened.
And who's telling the truth, yeah.
Right.
Because one of them is lying.
Yeah. But, yeah, it makes no sense because if she's so bloody, then why isn't Tonica, like, covered in anything?
Well, she said she had nothing to do with the attack.
Right. But, you know, what I mean? Also, where's the guy?
Right. So, police knew something had happened.
And clearly.
And Tonica saying that she wasn't involved with this attack, maybe that's true. But also, Melissa got bloody somehow.
Yeah.
And when she saw her walk into the KFC, she jumped over the counter to get away from her. She was so scared.
Yeah.
So it's not looking good.
None of it makes sense.
Yeah. They didn't know what the lead up to this situation was.
Yeah.
So officers continued questioning Tonica, and she said Melissa had the story all wrong. Of course she did.
Right.
She claimed Melissa was a drug addict and a thief. And that day, Melissa had been doing drugs with her cousin, Kyle Martin. Officers also learned that the house across the street from the KFC that Melissa had pointed to did belong to Tonica's parents. Tonica said Melissa had been at a house across the street that day, but it wasn't her parents' house. She had been hanging out at an abandoned property next to her parents' house. She said whatever occurred, it had been between Kyle and Melissa, but she had no involvement. Although Tonica seemed to be the more believable of the two at the time, officers decided to check the house for themselves. They wanted to see who else was there and if they could find anything at the scene that would give them some sort of insight to what had occurred. So they walked over to the home with Tonica, who agreed to let them into the house, but she did delay them a little bit. She told them that it was hard to get in and she needed to ring the doorbell because her parents were inside, and since they were elderly, it would take them a second or two to get to the door. But after a few minutes, officers were able to enter the home with Tonica. As soon as they started walking up to the house, they did notice that Tonica had started acting weird. And now that they were inside, the first place officers wanted to look was the basement. And as they made their way over to the stairs, the first thing they smelled was bleach. As they walked downstairs, they saw the basement wasn't finished and appeared to be used mainly for storage. There were bikes, boxes, and a refrigerator. They also noticed that Tonica's mother was on her hands and knees scrubbing something off of the basement floor.
Right.
They asked her what she was doing, and she told them that she had been cleaning up after their dogs because her grandbabies like to play down there.
Right. Okay, why don't you stop doing that?
Yeah. Officers then spotted blood spatter on the stairs and a couple other locations in the basement. It was clear that something had obviously happened down there and they needed to investigate further. They needed to see what other physical evidence might still remain at that house. So they put Tonica in police custody.
Yeah, I was like, and she's going in.
Yeah. And other officers focused on finding her cousin, Kyle, because both Melissa and Tonica had said, well, Kyle was involved in some regard. So there were some officers in the basement with Tonica and her mother, while others checked next door at the other residence, and that was where they found Kyle Martin. Kyle was sweaty and scratched up, so they handcuffed him and led him outside. And when officers brought Kyle out to the street, they saw that there were other officers with Tonica, who was handcuffed. At the point Kyle saw that Tonica was handcuffed, he said, "Hey, you can uncuff her and let her go. This was all me." He told officers that he was the one that had attacked and assaulted Melissa. So with that admission, police released Tonica and took Kyle in for further questioning. Getting closer to what happened, but still very confusing.
He could also be lying, you know?
Totally.
So, yeah, time will tell here.
When police looked into Kyle Martin's history, he had an extensive criminal background.
Also, wait, Grandma was cleaning the blood spatter?
Yep. Well, Tonica's mother.
Or, yeah, Tonica's, but you know what I mean. Like, Also, like, she knew there was blood down. Like, why did she just, like, lead them there? I don't get it. Dude, I don't know.
That's what they were thinking. They're like, wait.
Like, why, what's happening?
Why is she letting us in if there's, like, an active crime scene down here?
Right. And then also, Tanaka's mom is, like, in on it and, yeah, like, lying about the dog poop.
Right. And it's an unfinished basement. And she's like, oh, yeah, my grandbabies like to play down here. So I'm just scrubbing the concrete.
Yeah, no one likes to play in an unfinished basement. Right. Okay. So we're on the same page.
Sure. So they look into Kyle Martin and see that his criminal background is extensive. He had charges for receiving stolen property, carrying concealed weapons, selling of illicit drugs, and grand theft. So while waiting on a warrant to inspect the scene further, investigators employed a little trickery to get Kyle to talk. They told Kyle that Melissa had passed away. Jay Hodge, who was one of the detectives, said there is no clean-cut rule about being entirely truthful in their interview with a suspect during an investigation, so they could lie to him to get him to talk. And so they did.
Do they use this in court later?
They could,
that's,
yeah.
That's just interesting.
Yeah, they could. I mean, they can't lie to you in court.
I mean, his defense. Can they use the fact that they lied to him?
I don't think so. I think that's what the detective was saying, was like, there is no rule saying that we can't lie to him.
So it's just all fair game.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So they told him that Melissa had passed away. Keep in mind, he had just admitted that he had attacked Melissa. So if Melissa had died, that makes his charges way worse.
Oh, yeah.
And so this worked because it added a ton of pressure and he broke. He suddenly became very cooperative and wanted to give his side of the story. And Jay Hodge said that this was easily the most diabolical and thought out incident he ever had to investigate. But before we get into exactly what happened, let's go back in time a little bit. Tanaka Jenkins grew up in East Cleveland, Ohio, with her mother, father, and two brothers. She had a normal upbringing and was a very ambitious child. Her father was a retired police officer and a plumber, and she and her mother were very close. From a very early age, Tanaka was considered the smart one of the family. She had done well in her classes throughout her time in high school and ended up with straight-A transcripts from Cayuga County Community College and then Central State University in the 1990s. She then applied for a graduate program at Yale University in their neuroscience department, a program which only accepted 8 to 10 students per year at a time.
Whoa.
Tanaka had straight A's and a ton of glowing letters of recommendation, one of which was from a professor at Cayuga Community College and one from Central University, so she got in. And on top of this, she was able to get a full ride as well as $16,000 additionally with a grant.
Wow, good for her.
So in 1997, Tanaka moved to New Haven, Connecticut to attend Yale grad school. But during her classwork, her professor was confused, because she was definitely not at the level she should have been at for being in this prestigious neuroscience track. She was failing classes and exams. First, he approached Tanaka and asked what was going on, and she gave a bunch of excuses, but things were weird enough that they wanted to do a little bit of digging. So he contacted her community college to ask how he could support her better and help her learn the best. But this was when things started to unravel. The letters of recommendation Tanaka had were not even written by real people. And when they contacted the registration office, it turned out she had never even attended college.
Wait, so she's never been to college, but she's at a Yale graduate program?
Yes, in a program that only accepts 8 to 10 people per year.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. And she thought that she would, what, just get away? Like, what do you mean? Just skip the whole undergrad?
Fake it till you make it, I guess.
That it doesn't work in neuroscience, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe there's some areas, but that is not one of them. And like what? You're going to like operate on people? Is that the long-term plan? Like this is insane.
Yeah, I really don't know what her long-term goal was because she didn't get very far.
I was like, you have to fake it for like what, 12 years?
I mean, she did get far because she got into Yale and also got a full ride and $16,000 additional dollars for, you know, room and board and food and whatever.
Yeah.
In the 90s.
In the 90s.
Yeah.
My God.
She had created a fake paper trail that made her look like a gifted young neuroscientist, when in fact, she was not. And it turned out, not only had she duped Yale, but also Baylor College of Medicine in Texas also accepted her. But she ended up accepting Yale. So she's like, oh no, I'm not going to go to Baylor. I'll go to Yale.
I go to Yale.
With my fake paper trail.
$16,000.
And a full ride.
That's crazy.
Yep. So Tanaka was expelled from Yale, and the police were called because she had taken a ton of scholarship money, falsified documents, and took the spot in the neuroscience program that someone else actually deserved. So she was arrested and charged with first-degree larceny and second-degree fraud. In December of 1997, police were called out to the school, and as they arrested her, Tanaka put up a scene. They literally dragged her out of Yale, kicking and screaming. She even tried to escape the police car, so then they tacked on another charge of attempting to escape police custody.
Yep, not good.
She was taken to the police station where she was charged and booked and given an attorney, Norman Pattis. Norman reassured Tanaka, telling her since she didn't have anything else on her record, she might be fine as long as she pled guilty. But Tanaka didn't want to plead guilty. Norm told her, look, there was a ton of proof that she forged the documents and did what they were accusing her of, so it would be way easier for her if she just pled guilty. But when her court date arrived in July of 1998, Tanaka didn't even show up. When she was arrested, she got a $10,000 bond and she had managed to bail herself out of jail, so they didn't know where she was. Her defense attorney made efforts to call her and find her, but they couldn't. So Judge Roland D. Fasano had to issue a bench warrant for her failure to appear. The cops had to go looking for her, and when they got to her home in East Cleveland, she was just there.
Right. I don't get it. Does she not understand?
She clearly thinks that she's much smarter than everyone else.
I mean, maybe, but like, if you're going to not show up, did you think they were just going to forget about the charges?
Yeah, let it go.
I don't understand.
I don't either.
Like, if you're not going to show up, then you would run, right? You wouldn't just stay at your home?
Yeah, she just went home.
It doesn't make sense either way. You either show up or run.
Not Tanaka.
No. There's a third option.
Yeah, so she had a very dramatic explanation for why she couldn't be at court. She said the reason she didn't make it to court was because she had been kidnapped.
Right.
According to Tanaka, as she was shopping, a man approached her with a gun and made her get into the trunk of her car. He drove her somewhere, raped her, and then threw her in the trunk again, drove her to Philadelphia, where he dumped the car and her. And somehow, Tanaka managed to get out of the trunk and drive herself home. She said she made a police report and went to the hospital and everything, and that was why she couldn't go to court. She was fighting for her life. Tanaka's defense attorney said it stretched even what he was willing to believe. This was difficult, but he was going to try to go with it and spare her from getting harsher punishment. But then a few days later, Tanaka's attorney Norm received an anonymous delivery of photographs of Tanaka bound and gagged in the trunk. It showed Tanaka looking directly at the camera, eyes wide, with something tied over her mouth. This was all extremely odd and over the top. Who took the photos? Why did they end up at the attorney? It raised serious credibility concerns, and this photo was very over the top. Like, it looked staged. They also looked into if she actually had filed a police report, as she said she had, but unsurprisingly, she never filed one, so that was a lie as well.
Yeah, did she go to the hospital?
No.
Well.
And that wasn't all. Tanaka's lawyer also received a letter stating that Tanaka had been kicked out of Yale, not because of fraud, but because of racial hatred. It accused several faculty members of a bribery scheme, saying that the only reason she got kicked out was because someone just didn't want a black woman in this program or something. And that really didn't make any sense either. And despite the insane excuses and behavior, Tanaka's attorney was...
Also, I'm sorry, that really doesn't make sense. They gave you a full ride and 16 grand on top of that.
Right.
So they wanted you there.
Yes. Yeah. She was just doing anything she could.
Yeah.
Sending fake photos of her bound and gagged in a trunk. And like, she's like, okay, that didn't work. So let's send another anonymous parcel to my attorney and see if that sticks, which it didn't. Despite the insane excuses and behavior, Tanaka's attorney was able to negotiate a plea deal for her to repay the money she took from Yale and only serve 3 years of probation. This was a really good deal, because if she followed all the rules of her probation for a period of time, all of her charges would have been dismissed.
Yep.
Norm,
I have a feeling,
was very good at his job. But Tanaka's police record shows that months after starting her probation, she was arrested again. this time in Florida.
Wait, so she took the plea deal?
Yeah, she took the plea deal. And they were like, listen, all you have to do is just follow the rules of your probation and you will get these charges dropped.
Yeah, you have a clean slate.
Yeah. But then she got arrested in Florida only a few months later. They learned that Tanika and her mother, Tanika Clement, were up for a trial for trafficking drugs. After Tanika got out of jail, she went back home to her mother, who she was very close to, and now she had to figure out how she was going to pay back the $16,000 she owed to Yale. So in March of 2000, she and her mother decided they were going to take a crack at being drug dealers. Their plan was to go from Ohio to Tampa, Florida, meet with who they believed were Colombian drug traffickers, and purchase 22 pounds of cocaine, which is about 10 kilos. This ranged in price from $13,000 to $26,000 per kilo. So this was potentially $130,000 worth of cocaine, or more. Instead of getting in contact with an actual supplier, Tanika and her mother spoke to an undercover agent for Homeland Security.
Right.
So she and her mother would come to Florida, have a meeting with this guy, and negotiate a deal, but they should bring $100,000. They made an arrangement for the women to meet them in Tampa at a warehouse that they controlled, meaning Homeland Security. They couldn't make an arrest until they actually exchanged money. So when they got to the warehouse, the undercover officer let them know that he needed to see the money, and the women pulled out the cash in vacuum-seal bags. Once he saw the money, he made a phone call where a second undercover officer showed up with tons of cocaine. Tanika cut it and taste-tested it with her pinky, which, according to detectives, no professional drug dealer ever does. Nobody with any sense puts their finger in anything and tastes it without actually knowing what it is. So the undercover agents knew these women had just been watching way too much television. Because you see that happen in like drug TV shows and things, but apparently not in real life. Once Tanika and her mother handed the money over, the rest of the undercover team came into the room with their guns drawn and made the arrest. And Tanika once again came up with some outrageous story to get out of this, and apparently told officers that she was an FBI informant and was sent to Tampa to uncover a drug ring by Special Agent Todd Platt. It turned out Tanika and her mother had actually been informants at one time, but that relationship had been over for a long time at that point, and it was very easy for them to uncover that Tanika was not actually working with the FBI, and she and her mother were just arrested.
I mean, it's a decent cover story if it were, you know, at all plausible.
Yeah, but that's so easy for them to check.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, as far as lies go, it's not a bad one.
I guess.
But it was pretty immediately, like, dismissed.
Yeah, they're like, hey, so no, you're not.
Todd like, Platt doesn't exist.
Yeah, or even if he did, they're like, we called him up and he said no. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, so they were arrested. They were charged with conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute 5 kilograms or more of cocaine. With those charges, they were facing a mandatory minimum sentence of 10 years up to life imprisonment. They had their initial appearance in federal court in Tampa, and the judge granted them a bond so they could go home to Cleveland prior to the trial. And as a condition of her bond, Tanika Jenkins was going to be required to wear an ankle monitor. So now that Tanika was back home in Cleveland, she needed to come up with something else that could get her out of this impending jail time, and possibly life in prison. So she came up with the idea that she couldn't be sent to prison if she were dead. Tanika's cousin Kyle Martin had just gotten out of prison himself after about 7 years, so she called him up and told him that she needed his help with something. She told Kyle she needed him to find a woman who resembled her, ideally someone addicted to crack. And I don't actually know that Kyle knew Tanika's true motives at this point and was a little confused, but Tanika told him not to worry about it, so he did what she asked him to. And a few days later, while Kyle was out, he spotted a woman who was strung out that looked a lot like Tanika. So he picked Tanika up, and the two of them drove up to Melissa Latham. Melissa Rochelle Latham was born July 14, 1973. She also grew up in East Cleveland with her 4 siblings. Her father was a truck driver, and her mother was a nurse, and she had a typical childhood. They had chores and Bible study, and sat down every night and ate dinner together like a family. Melissa was described as very bubbly and outgoing and always made her family laugh. But despite a happy childhood, the 90s were very difficult for Melissa and her family. Her mother was going through addiction, and her father did all he could. But dealing with her mother's active addiction for most of her life, Melissa started acting out herself. When she was 13 years old, she got pregnant and had a baby, and she got pregnant again a few years after that. And like her mother, Melissa started using drugs as an escape. The difference between Melissa and her mother was she was still able to function on drugs, so her family almost didn't know that she was struggling with addiction until it became extremely obvious. She started looking and acting different and would be out all night long. Melissa eventually had 7 children, and to fund her drug use, she turned to a life of petty crime.
7 children?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so many.
It's a lot of kids. She would steal things to get by, and often she would get caught and have to spend time down at the county jail until her court date. But when she got out, she would go right back to doing what she had been. As a result, the state declared Melissa an unfit mother and placed her children in foster care, which crushed her and made her sink deeper into her addiction. Melissa had tried to get help a few times, but eventually she would always turn back to doing drugs. And as she entered her late 20s, the family moved from East Cleveland to the suburb of Oakwood in the late 90s, hoping this would help her turn her life around. She started working on and off, and she got a job at McDonald's, and things were looking up. Having a job gave her more clarity and purpose, but she was still struggling. And she would always find a way to get high. And that was what happened the night that she met Tonika Jenkins. It was about 2 a.m. when Tonika and Kyle pulled up to Melissa in a red car as she was walking down Euclid Avenue. Kyle was in the back seat and Tonika was driving. They asked her if she wanted to make some cash, and since Melissa was still desperate for money, she was open to it. They told her they were going to do a little insurance scam, and all she had to do was go to a few dentist appointments. Melissa didn't quite know how an insurance scam would work with her just going to a few dentist appointments, but she didn't ask too many questions. Tonika told her they would go in the morning since it was already so late, so they took her to grab some food and then back to Tonika's house where they would do some drugs. And when they got up the next morning, Tonika gave Michelle a gray Yale sweatshirt and some gloves that she had to wear during the visit. All Melissa had to do was go to the dentist and get a cleaning and some x-rays, and then they would give her some money. Seemed pretty simple as far as Melissa was concerned. Tonika would even fill out the paperwork and use a fake name so it would never be tracked back to Melissa, and then they would pay her for the appointment. So Tonika and Melissa went into Pearl Dental Practice in Strongsville, and they had her x-rays done. And after the appointment, it seemed like Tonika and Kyle were very happy with her work. They even invited her back to Tonika's house again to do more drugs. That night, Melissa and Kyle smoked crack well into the night. And after falling asleep for a few hours, Melissa said she woke up and went to use the bathroom to brush her teeth and freshen up. But when she came out, all the lights in the basement were off. She tried calling out for them to turn the lights back on because she couldn't see anything, but the next thing she knew, she was being hit in the head and wrestled to the ground. When the lights came back on, she was on the ground, but she realized Kyle had been the one attacking her and Tonika was still in the room. She began frantically asking them, "Why are you doing this to me?" She hadn't stolen anything. She asked them, "What had she done?" But they weren't responding or letting her up. Kyle then picked up a sledgehammer, and Tonika told him, "Don't use that, just use the bricks." So he hit her in the head with a brick about 3 times, followed by Tonika grabbing a brick and hitting her 2 more. Melissa had been putting up a fight, but eventually she ran out of energy to fight back. She then heard one of them say, "She isn't passed out yet," which was when she began feeling needles being stuck into her body. Tonika had been injecting her with something, which turned out to be her mother's insulin. Tonika said she just wanted Melissa to pass out. So hearing this, Melissa decided her best bet was to play dead, because if she didn't play dead, she would be soon enough. So as Melissa went limp and they thought she was unconscious, Tonika told Kyle they needed to get her ankle monitor off of her and put it on Melissa, and then they were going to roll her up in a rug, take her to the abandoned house next door, and light her body on fire. Because she's gonna be me, and I'm gonna be dead. As Melissa was lying on the floor playing dead, she heard Tonika say all they would have to identify her is her dental records. and Melissa was terrified.
Oh my God. The plan is so calculated and cold. Like, my God.
At that point, Tanaka
and her mom is in on it?
Her mom was in on buying 10 kilos of cocaine.
Ugh, disgusting.
At that point, Tanaka had Kyle go upstairs with her to find something to wrap Melissa's body up so they could dispose of her. And as soon as Melissa heard the doors closing and the two of them were upstairs, she stood up. She was very dizzy from the insulin, but she grabbed the spoon that she and Kyle had been using the night before to cook drugs with, and she used the end of it to pry the basement door open. Outside, there was a pit bull in the yard, and she said she's scared as hell of pit bulls, but she wasn't scared that day. She ignored it and ran across the street into the KFC, screaming, "They tried to kill me. Can someone please call 911? Which brings us back to April 24th, 2001. Kyle was in the interrogation room and Melissa was in the hospital. Officers didn't know any of this and were still trying to figure out what had happened, so they told Kyle that Melissa was dead and that got him talking. He told them most of that story. He told them they wanted Melissa to do some insurance fraud with them, which she did, and then she spent the night at Tanaka's house after they did drugs. But then he told the police that the following morning, things took a turn for the worse. According to Kyle, he had woken up paranoid from using drugs the night before. Melissa was still there, which kind of upset him because he didn't feel comfortable with her being there. And while she was in the bathroom, Kyle noticed that some crack and $800 was missing. When Melissa came out of the bathroom, Kyle was agitated and struck her in the forehead and also the back of the head. Tanaka, who was upstairs at the time, heard the commotion and came into the basement. She asked what was going on, and at that point, Kyle told her, "She's your problem." Kyle then mentioned that Tanaka assaulted Melissa with the brick. She was laying in a pool of blood, and Kyle watched Tanaka inject her at least 4 times in the left arm with insulin. At that time, Kyle asked Tanaka what she was doing. He claimed he left the basement to get some air, and Tanaka joined him. And that was when Melissa got away. Tanaka then took the brick and the syringes used in the assault, wrapped them in a gray plastic bag, and took them next door to the abandoned area between the houses and threw it over the fence. He made no mention of attempting to fake Tanaka's death by burning Melissa alive with Tanaka's ankle monitor on. But now that they had Kyle's story and more of the truth, they knew they needed to visit Melissa in the hospital to check on her condition and see what she had to say about the attack. When they arrived at the hospital, officers were unable to interview her because she was still out of it. She had 6 stitches to the front of her forehead and 25 to 30 staples to the back of her head from the attack with the brick. Due to the insulin that was injected into her body, her blood sugar was dangerously low. When investigators talked to Melissa's doctors, her injuries seemed to match the story that Kyle gave. They confirmed that a heavy blunt object had caused a lot of the damage, and her insulin levels were off the charts, which also connected with what Kyle had said. Melissa was in critical condition, and they were very concerned that she wouldn't pull through. But the day after Kyle's confession, officers got the news that Melissa had regained consciousness. When she did wake up, doctors told her that she was very lucky to be alive. But now she was finally able to talk to the police. They wanted to be sensitive to her and her condition, but they wanted her to identify the suspects, and she did identify both Kyle Martin and Tanaka Jenkins as the people that had attacked her, and Melissa told police everything she could remember. The story was pretty much identical to Kyle's, except for the whole attempting to fake Tanaka's death part, which Melissa knew was the motive of the attack because she had only been playing dead and heard them talking about it. For investigators, Melissa's story changed everything. And when investigators contacted the dental office in Strongsville, they also confirmed everything. Tanaka had paid for the appointment in cash, had Melissa wear gloves so she wouldn't leave behind any fingerprints, and she gave her the Yale sweatshirt so if the police questioned the employees there, they would remember that article of clothing which linked back to Tanaka. Isn't that insane?
Yeah, the amount of detail she thought of is...
terrifying?
Yes, terrifying.
Yeah. Giving her gloves. At first, when I heard that detail, I was like, why is she having her wear gloves? And then yeah. I realized that the fingerprints could have potentially been collected. And just the simple, you know, detail of having her wear the Yale sweatshirt, even though like she somewhat resembles Tonika and they don't have any other proof of her, it not being her. She's like, well, I'll put her in a Yale sweatshirt.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what else to say. It's just the whole thing is so disgusting and evil. Terrifying and evil. Yeah.
Investigators needed to figure out why Tonika wanted to fake her own death in the first place. So they began looking into her past and her criminal history, and they were shocked by what they found. They learned about the Yale incident, the drug trafficking charges, and the jail time Tonika was facing, and the quote-unquote ankle bracelet that Melissa had described in her account of the story was actually an ankle monitor that Tonika was required to wear from the previous conviction. The whole plot became so much more clear and very nefarious. It went from a robbery over drugs and money to an attempted murder case. But the only person detained at that point was Kyle Martin. They had let Tonika go because Kyle said, only I did this, it wasn't her fault, so just let her go. And they did. After speaking with the U.S. attorney and the head agent for her case, they were able to get two warrants, one for Tonika for attempted murder, and for her mother for tampering with evidence, complicity, and obstruction. Investigators returned to the house where Melissa had been attacked and discovered that both women were gone. Tonika and her mother had already left the state to stand trial for the drug case that they were trying to avoid, so prosecutors in Cleveland had to just wait their turn. In April of 2001, they made it to Tampa for their trial. Once prosecutors found out about the attempted murder of Melissa Latham, they were also shocked, because both of these things separately are so big on their own, but then when you put them together in the span of like a few months, it's like, who are we actually dealing with here?
Right, yeah. The other thing that I keep thinking about is that she could have just gotten a job and gotten her life back. Clean slate.
Oh, yeah.
Just had to pay off Yale.
$16,000, yeah.
And then she was free.
Right. She didn't have to do any of this. Her solution to paying back Yale was, we're going to become massive drug dealers and make this money and then pay it back, I guess. But like...
like, they're not going to ask where that came from so quickly.
Right. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
It was
actively shocking.
I know. And stupid.
Yeah.
Stupid as well. Like, this whole thing is very thought out and very scary and evil, but also really dumb.
Yep.
So there's that as well. It was one thing to go from committing fraud to selling drugs, but it was a whole other thing to attempt to murder a woman so she could put her ankle monitor on her body and fake her own death. Because also, where was she going to go after this? After she successfully faked her death, was she going to change her name? Was she going to assume the identity of Melissa Latham? Like, it's well thought out, but it's also not.
Short term, yeah.
I feel like all of this has been short term. She can only really, like, conceptualize the short term.
Yeah.
So Tonika and Tonika were both found guilty on two counts: conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute 5 kilograms or more of cocaine, and possession with the intent to distribute. The judge ended up sentencing Tonika to 24 years and 7 months, and Tonika was sentenced to 15 years and 7 months. Officers and prosecutors in Cleveland had to wait a couple of years before they were able to extradite them back to Florida to try Tonika. And also Tonika, because she had charges as well. In February of 2003, Tonika Jenkins and her mother were brought back to Ohio to face the attempted murder charges. They presented 16 witnesses that testified. The picture that was painted was one that Tonika Jenkins was the mastermind behind what happened to Melissa. They called several witnesses from the dental office who corroborated Melissa's story, and although Kyle didn't testify, they were able to present his confession during questioning. The defense had no witnesses to call at all, but they did everything they could to discredit Melissa on the stand. They tried painting her as an unreliable crackhead, but despite that, she did incredibly well. She was able to recount all the details from that night and admit to her mistakes. She also pointed out Tonika as the woman who attacked her. And the evidence spoke for itself. They had the dentist documents, the clothes, the brick, the needle, Melissa's wounds, and all the blood they found in the basement that belonged to Melissa. In just one day, the jury returned their verdict. Tonica was found guilty of 2 counts of tampering with evidence, attempted aggravated murder, complicity to commit murder, kidnapping, and felonious assault. She was sentenced to 20 years in an Ohio penitentiary. Tonica was found guilty of obstructing justice and was sentenced to 1 year. And in a separate trial, Kyle Martin was found guilty of kidnapping and sentenced to 10 years. Kyle claimed that he was scared of Tonica because she would have killed him too. He was just trying to make it seem like he didn't have anything to do with this. And in 30 years as a federal prosecutor, Jeff Downing had never seen anyone try to fake their own death to avoid going to jail. He believed Tonica received a pretty appropriate sentence, but Kyle should have received a lot more time. He had a lot more involvement in this ordeal than he admitted to, as well as Tonica. Both Tonica Clement and Kyle Martin have completed their sentences, but Tonica Jenkins is currently incarcerated at the Ohio Reformatory for Women and will serve a total of 36 years for the Florida drug conviction and attempted murder of Melissa Latham. Her projected release date is 2039, when she's 63 years old. Melissa said, quote, "Tonica Jenkins is cold, but she's not cold enough. I've got scars, but I'm still me. I'm still Melissa Rochelle Latham at the end of the day." She also said, "I know addiction is a beast, but try to be aware of your surroundings and try to get help because there is help out there, and forgive yourself." And as far as I know, Melissa is doing better. I hope she's figured her addiction out and it's no longer an issue, but there isn't a ton of information on where she is today.
I mean, it's just tough to be, she was exposed to drugs like when she was 13.
Earlier than 13, that was when she started. Actually, I don't know if she started doing drugs at 13, but she had her first baby at 13.
Yeah, I mean, to overcome that, it's super tough.
Yeah, insanely tough. It's also scary to think about what could have happened if Tonica hadn't entered the KFC and kind of incriminated herself a little bit. I mean, Melissa pointed out the house. She had undeniable wounds to her head. She was, you know, bloody. But the paramedics thought that this was a drug-induced episode, and they weren't really taking her seriously for the first bit of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know what they deal with on an everyday basis, but I mean, she got those somehow, you know?
Right, totally.
Something happened, especially if it's in the back of the head. Like, I don't know if you could really do that to yourself.
No, probably not. And I'm sure they would have put the pieces together eventually. But if Tonica hadn't entered the KFC and she like actually thoroughly cleaned up the scene and disposed of, you know, the bricks and the needle and the everything, then it really just would have been her word against Melissa Latham's. And Melissa was a drug addict. So yeah. Who is the police going to believe?
Well, I still think she would have had a shot because Tonica was facing federal charges in Florida. That would have come up.
That's true. I guess that is true. But I'm just thinking about, like, I don't know, she presented herself as if she was this like put together person who's just had her money stolen. But yeah, I don't know. I just wonder what would have happened if they would have actually pursued it the same way that they had if Tonica hadn't like come in and been like, yes, here I am. And also my cousin's involved. And yes, we are in that house over there and you can come inside.
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, she was very dumb when it comes to being a criminal, which is great because she's a very dangerous person. So she, you know, is where she belongs. But yeah, I guess I was just thinking about like, you know, a drug addict coming in and saying that they're, you know, in trouble might not be taken as seriously as what it became if it hadn't unfolded in the way that it did.
Yeah, we'll never know.
And I'm glad. I'm glad it didn't go that way because I just worried that she wouldn't have been taken seriously, but she was. And, you know, even Kyle was like, oh, I did it. Even before he thought that Melissa was dead, which is just interesting.
Well, no, they lied to him, right?
No, but to get him in cuffs and like taken, because they had both Tonica and Kyle in cuffs. And then Kyle was like, let her go. I did it. And then he got into the questioning room and then he was told Melissa's dead, which is when he admitted to about half of the story.
Right.
I also wonder how much he actually knew going into Tonica's scheme. Did he know that she was trying to fake her own death and that's why she wanted someone who looked like her and was a drug addict? Because she wanted someone who was a drug addict because she thought they wouldn't be missed.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say. It's just all around terrible.
It is terrible. Can you also imagine being the KFC employees.
Yeah, you're just like working at KFC.
Yeah, you're just like a regular shift. It's like 5:30. Dinner rush is about to come in.
Well, not anymore. Yeah, also then you just have to like go on with your day.
Yep.
Like after this attempted murder crime scene comes to your workplace and then you're just like, yeah, do you want fries with that? Like
they they also don't get the resolution of it. You know?
Yeah. It's just like they all just go away.
Because they're not...
You have no idea.
They're not the police. They're not a part of the investigation. They don't get to like know that everything worked out. They just know that this woman came in and claimed that she was just, you know, beaten with a brick and injected with insulin. And the woman who walked in who looks totally normal is the one who did it. Like,
yeah,
what happened?
Mind-bending.
Like,
I don't know. I feel like they would have done a story on it. Or if they really wanted to, they could look up the case. You know?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, they get the answers, right? But like, Tanaka wasn't charged or like didn't go to trial for it for years later because she was in Florida and they had to wait to extradite her back to Ohio.
Yeah. Well, justice takes a little while.
It does, unfortunately. But yeah, this one was just a very shocking case. And also good on Melissa for playing dead when she did, because that's the only thing that saved her life.
Yeah.
By all accounts, I believe she is doing better. So that's positive. And I'm also glad that Tanaka is away and Kyle and Tanika, I guess they served their time, but went away for however long that they did. Like they should have gotten more time, in my opinion. But yeah, I think it's safe to say that we both wish Melissa well and hope she's doing better.
Amen.
But anyway, a bit of a sharp left turn into a transition. Tell me what your good thing is so that we can go on with our days as normal.
My good thing is that we are taking a little long weekend up to Traverse City, and I'm really excited about that because Michigan rocks in the summer.
It does. It's a sleeper agent.
Yes, and Traverse City rocks. I'll tell anyone from out of state who will listen about it. So yeah, love going there, and definitely looking forward to some time off.
Yeah.
What's your good thing?
My good thing is that we spent the whole day yesterday painting our living room a new color, and now it's very blue. Bluer than I realized it would be, but still good. I'm going to trust the vision.
Okay.
No, I do really like it.
We love a tentative good thing.
I do really like it, but like we still have the plastic everywhere.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a mess.
The furniture is not put back in place. And so it's just like a very blue room with nothing on the walls. And so I just need to put everything away and put it back to where it should be and put up like art and stuff to see the actual vision. But for now, it's just a very blue room. Which is cool. That's what I wanted, and I got it. But it went from being white to very blue, so it's just like a jarring.
it's a contrast for sure. But we're trusting the process, and if we hate it, we'll paint it again.
That's true. It's only one day for painting, basically.
Right.
But I don't think that's going to happen. I really do think it's all going to come together. It's just a matter of styling.
Yeah. Well, it would be really frustrating because we bought 9 samples.
Well, yeah.
Try out.
Finding the right shade of paint is really hard.
Yeah.
And don't even get me started on whites and beiges and things like that, because I haven't even come close to finding the right one. But the living room is blue, and that's pretty cool. And that's my good thing. But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to check out our bonus episodes and take place in the poll that is happening right now, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. Check out my YouTube channel over at Steph Today, where I tell stories similar to this one. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you would like to share it with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listener's episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the TNM Podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.